It is Monday, October the 10th. This is VOA's International Edition. So good to have you with us. Coming up, U.S. presidential candidates taking voter questions. Also ahead, a deadly airstrike at a funeral in Yemen.
My suspicion is that it is a deliberate attack. The fact that there were some senior Houthis in the audience, probably they had some sort of intelligence that they'd be there. The Saudis have, I think, been targeting civilian targets all the way through this conflict.
And we'll have the latest on the U.S. economic growth, plus helping young people interested in becoming entertainers. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The U.S. presidential race is continuing, and in recent hours, Democratic Party presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump took part in a town hall-style debate. It was at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. The voters were asking questions this time around, the second of three debates planned before that election on November 8th to decide who will be the next president. Joining us to review it all is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, thanks so much for being here. Well, going into this debate, there was a lot of buzz about this 11-year-old video in which Trump made some lewd remarks about women. I guess there was a question or two about that.
There were indeed. There was a lot of focus on that. Hillary Clinton was asked about it. She said the video in which Trump, as we know, bragged about going after a married woman and was very vulgar in his terms of describing women and use of his star power. Hillary Clinton said this is exactly who Donald Trump is, and not only in his treatment of women, but she went on to recite some of the other controversial things he said about Hispanics, African Americans, Muslims, for example. And she used it to make the case that, in her view, Trump is not fit to be president. Trump, for his part, came back to it. Tried to say again he apologized, he does not represent who he is, but he didn't go much further than that. He also repeated the line that it was locker room banter. And I think this is the key point. Trump came in under the gun in this debate. He was very aggressive throughout the debate on Clinton. At one point called her the devil, repeatedly called her a liar. So he didn't spare any attacks. That probably will play well with his core base of supporters. But was he able to do something that wins over more moderate voters, the people he needs to win, and especially on the issue of the tape about his comments about women? It seems like he left some things to be desired
there. You know, I've seen in social media that some people actually like it when he talks like that, when he acts like that. They say, this is how a leader should be.
Yeah, his supporters love it. I'm sure they embrace the fact that he was very aggressive in attacking Hillary Clinton throughout the evening, attacking her record as Secretary of State, attacking the email server issue while she was Secretary of State. But again, he was interrupting her many times. He was aggressively pushing the arguments, and that cost him in the first debate. So, you know, people always say, who came out the winner? I think in their own way, they each accomplished something they set out to do. He had to hold his base of support that's withering right now because of this the videotape. And she simply had to continue to be calm, cool, and collected. And I think, you know, she was able to pull that off. But it was kind of an ugly debate, to be honest. It was a lot of a very contentious debate.
Yeah. You know, there are a lot of issues that matter to Americans. Immigration, economy, trade, unemployment, Syria, Iraq. Did they get around to any of those?
Yeah, they did. In fact, there was a long discussion at one point about Iraq, but it got into Trump's critique of the military and why are we signaling when we're going to attack in Mosul, you know, and also what should be done in Syria, and Clinton bringing up that she believes Russia's behind the hacking here in the United States, including the election, and that they want Trump to win. Now, he dismissed that idea. But so, you know, Everything in foreign policy was also very tense in terms of the arguments back and forth. And there is one more debate to go. So we still have one more to endure.
Speaking about these debates, there were a lot of them leading up to the nominations to begin with, and now we've had these three, or will have these three soon. Do they, in your experience, do they really make a difference when it comes around to voting?
I think they do. I think the debates, you can make the argument in the primaries, that's how Donald Trump got the nomination to a large extent. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the first debate, which is usually considered the most important of the presidential debates in the general, Clinton was given generally a victory by a lot of people. Since that time, her poll standings have increased quite a bit. And now with his problems with the videotape, will this debate, his stronger performance here, will it matter much? We'll have to wait and see in the days ahead.
Very good. Jim Malone, our national correspondent, thank you so much for being here. Later in the program, we'll look at the social media reaction to what went on at that debate. Also in the news, survivors of Hurricane Matthew's assault on Haiti are trying to regather their lives, but so many obstacles seem to stand in the way, such as the broad devastation. The Category 4 storm, with top sustained winds of about 200 kilometers per hour, battered Haiti last week, leaving many thousands homeless and, according to Reuters, well over 900 people dead. The international relief organization World Vision is one of the many groups trying to help the people of Haiti get through all of this. VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with World Vision's national director in Haiti, John Hasse, about the devastation.
What we're seeing, our assessment teams are saying, and our partners are saying, that 80 to 90% of the houses and people's livelihoods, their crops, their cows, their trees, their mango trees, their banana trees, they're all destroyed. Just, scenes of just destruction. I was, many of our staff, they live through the earthquake, and yet they're just seeing, they're almost speechless when they see what the destruction is.
Well, the full force of the Category 4 storm glanced by Haiti, but I think the southwestern tip was the hardest hit.
Yeah, in those areas, just the destruction is almost, it's awe-striking. I mean, it really is, like I said, 80 to 90% of those areas are just flattened. I mean, the pictures that we're seeing and the assessments that I've seen and even the scenes that I've seen myself, they're just, trees down on top of houses, families without their homes. It's just sewer, the sewage from the latrines and other things are coming out. So that whole area there is devastated. Some other hard hits are like Lagunav, the island in the middle. The western side took a really hard blow. 50% of the houses are destroyed there as well. And then the northwest as well, that's not getting a lot of attention, but what we're hearing from our partners that work there is it's also just extremely hard hit.
There's a quote from the UN humanitarian coordinator in Haiti. He said of the 1.3 million people in southern Haiti, with a poverty rate of 60 to 70%, we're not far from having 1 million people who are in urgent need of humanitarian assistance.
That's been our estimate. It's been a little over a million people, not just in the south, but in some of the other hard-hit areas. World Vision has a very strong presence in Lagunav, and we've seen just those areas be hit really hard as well. 50% of the people don't have a home anymore. In the south, again, just so many people are out of a house. They're in shelters or they're out in the open. So World Vision is rushing to get tarps and temporary supplies, non-food items such as like clean water kits. We're also getting them just a place so that they can stay in, they can stay dry. We're still in the rainy season, so it's raining at night. These are just some of the basic needs of people. We're already starting to mobilize food to these populations as well, so that they can eat and survive.
John, there are reports of several cases of cholera.
This is our biggest concern in the medium and long term. Even in the short term, it's just cholera is going to be one of the biggest issues, just because so many of the latrines and the sewage is in the streets. And people just don't have clean water. Their wells have been destroyed. They've been flooded. And so we very much expect cholera to resurface. And people can really support, like, you know, just a few dollars can go a long way to helping somebody have water, clean water, protecting children from cholera and other waterborne diseases. They can go to worldvision.org to make a donation, and just a small donation can go a long way.
Well, John, how long do you expect the recovery to take? Because that country survived a devastating earthquake back in 2010, and people were still living in tent cities at that time.
We're planning for probably about a 6-month response time, in the sense that, you know, initially we're just trying to keep people alive. We're trying to make sure that they have enough food, that they have clean water, so that they're protected from cholera and other things, other waterborne diseases. But, you know, it's going to very quickly transition into restoring their food crops. You know, that mean, like 80 to 90% of these crops have been destroyed. So helping them start replanting their beans and the corn and other things in the coming weeks. The growing season starts in a few weeks. So just getting, you know, that, and that's going to take a little while. And then restoring people's homes, getting them roofs back on their homes, helping them, you know, restore some of their basic the needs of cooking supplies, et cetera. These are also some of the things that we'll be doing, and that's why it'll take 3 to 6 months to do that.
That is World Vision's National Director in Haiti, John Hassey. He was speaking with my colleague, Victor Beatty. Hurricane Matthew also wreaked havoc on other Caribbean islands, including Jamaica, Cuba, the Dominican Republic, and the Bahamas. From there, it moved up portions of the Atlantic coast of the United States with 15 deaths here, widespread damage in its wake. You can get more on Hurricane Matthew at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA. A leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. Thousands of marchers took to the streets of Yemen's capital, Sana'a, on Sunday, protesting an apparent Saudi-led coalition airstrike that killed more than 140 people at a funeral on Saturday. A United Nations observer said more than 500 others were wounded. Saudi coalition officials initially denied any role in the bombing, but later announced an investigation of what it described as a regrettable and painful attack. Yemeni officials said the dead and wounded included military and security personnel of the Iran-backed Shiite Houthi rebel regime, seeking to oust the internationally recognized Saudi-backed government of President Abu Ramur Mansour Hadi. We asked University of New South Wales scholar Anthony Billingsley if the weekend airstrike on the funeral was deliberate.
My suspicion is that it is a deliberate attack. The fact that there were some senior Houthis in the audience, probably they had some sort of intelligence that they'd be there. The Saudis have, I think, been targeting civilian targets all the way through this conflict. I note that I think it's Human Rights Watch, for example, commented that perhaps a third of all the casualties have been civilians. There have been hospitals and schools bombed. The Saudis, of course, deny it at every step of the way, but it can't be anybody else. Islamic State claimed credit, for example, but that's just nonsense.
And we also asked Billingsley if the two sides in the Yemeni conflict are any closer to resolving things.
No. I think probably the Houthis would like to, but I think the Saudis are basically wanting a winner-take-all result. So they had peace talks in Kuwait, which might resume again next month. But the problem has been that the Saudis have basically submitted conditions to the Houthis that they know will not be acceptable, i.e. lay down all your arms and withdraw from the areas that you've conquered or captured. The Houthis will not do that. They could not afford to do that. They know that that would be very much to their disadvantage.
And could this most recent airstrike crystallize the conflict in Yemen?
Well, it's interesting. There's been a number of instances over the last week or so that have started to force the British and the Americans to reconsider. The problem is that the US and UK have got very lucrative arms deals with the Saudis. Obama, I think, still needs the Saudis to moderate their criticism of the deal with Iran. And so they've been very tolerant of Saudi misbehavior. Well, more than tolerant, they've actually been complicit, I think, in what the Saudis have been up to with various forms of assistance. Recently, the British announced that they were willing to consider an independent investigation of what was going on, of war crimes in the Yemen conflict, which is a change from their position of last year. The American government has, well, moderated its position, but still hasn't gone so far as to accept an independent investigation. But there are signs that numerous congressmen, for example, have been speaking out against what was going on. And I think the administration is starting to feel very uncomfortable about what the Saudis are doing.
University of New South Wales scholar Anthony Billingsley. By the way, the U.S. National Security Council spokesperson Ned Price said the U.S. is deeply disturbed by what happened there over the weekend and that the U.S. security cooperation with Saudi Arabia is not a blank check. Also in the news, U.S. economy, which is always a part of the political discussion, and this year's presidential race is no exception. While that economy continues to plod forward at a slow but steady pace, wages continued to rise last month, and more people started brushing up their resumes, it seems, to look for work. But as Millar Sega reports now, the pace of job growth and wages remains uneven for many.
In a mature, stable economy, now 7 years into the recovery, slow but steady job growth wins the race, says Bankrate senior economist Mark Hamrick on Skype.
Meaning that we aren't going to run out of steam because we're running too fast, but we want this economic recovery to continue for some time, perhaps even more than a couple of years. And right now, it looks like that's entirely possible.
And with U.S. companies adding 156,000 workers in September, it's an economic milestone of sorts, 72 straight months of positive job growth. Another good sign, wages grew faster than inflation. But on the downside, wage gains have been uneven along ethnic and gender lines, says Elise Gould at the Economic Policy Institute.
For instance, African-American median household income is about 59% of white median household income. That's a huge gap there. And they're still about 11% lower than they were in 2000. So there are seeing increases. It takes a lot to make up for all those losses.
Another important data point, the unemployment rate rose slightly to 5%. But that's a good thing, say economists, because it means more Americans are confident enough about the economy to start looking for work.
In this case, it was hundreds of thousands more Americans either working or looking for work. That is a better path toward higher unemployment, but longer term, we want to have both more people looking for work and working, and we want the unemployment rate to move down, not up.
Employment trends tend to carry more weight than usual with a presidential election only about a month away. But given the steady and unremarkable pace of job growth, short of a catastrophe, economists say it's unlikely to sway votes. Millar Sega, VOA News, Washington.
And as promised earlier in the program, it's time now to see what's trending online about the U.S. presidential race and the impact that leaked Trump video is having on the race. Our social media expert, G. Abby Lee, is here. What you got, G?
Hi, Steve. During the weekend, a leaked tape revealed Republican nominee Donald Trump discussing grabbing women's private parts without consent with TV host Billy Bush. He later appeared on camera and said, "I was wrong. I apologize." And he added, "Bill Clinton has actually abused women." And since the leaked tape, women took to Twitter to speak up about their experiences with sexual assault. It began with writer Kelly Oxford, who sent out a series of tweets condemning the rape culture and sharing her experiences. You can read her tweets at Kelly Oxford, and she encouraged people to use hashtag NotOkay when writing about theirs.
Yeah, I've seen a number of postings with that hashtag NotOkay. What was the response like?
When you search on Twitter using hashtag NotOkay, you can find an overwhelming number of responses. And here's an example from Emily Willingham. She's a biology professor and contributor to the Force magazine, and she tweeted, "I won't give details, but I was 12 and he went to jail." As for the overall reaction, this is what Oxford tweeted. She wrote, "Women have tweeted me sexual assault stories for 14 hours straight, minimum 50 per minute. Harrowing. Do not ignore hashtag not okay."
And as you might suspect, judging by the reactions on social media, you would question what this new development might do to affect Trump's run for the presidency.
Steve, it's hard to say nationwide, but at least in Ohio, the leaked conversation is not going to change his supporters' mind about his eligibility. 91% of likely Trump voters in Ohio said their views are unchanged after hearing the tape. In fact, 1% of his voters in Ohio said their views of Trump changed for the better after the leaked tape. The numbers are from CBS News.
Of course, the Trump story is big on social media, I understand, but there has to be something else out there trending.
Something just as fiery. Samsung Note 7 replacements are now reportedly being caught on fire. The company issued replacements for the Galaxy Note 7 earlier this year, but there are claims that 3 replacement phones have caught on fire. You can see photos of the damaged handsets on social media by searching Galaxy Note 7 replacement. Steve, back to you.
And many thanks to you, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. Always good to have you here, G. By the way, you can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, is on Twitter at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
1,200 kilometers in diameter, bearing 24.41 degrees.
That's tracking right towards us.
Based on current escalation, estimated force of 8,600 newtons.
Scientists say that dust storms on Mars aren't as powerful as the one that set up the plot to the hit movie and book The Martian. But these storms could still present some serious challenges for astronauts who will someday land on and explore the red planet. Local Martian dust storms are somewhat common and can occasionally grow into regional storms. There have also been rare occasions when the storms can grow into a global event. Researchers at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory are predicting a global Martian dust storm in the next few weeks to a few months. If this prediction is proven correct, it might be possible to develop a system that can forecast future global dust storms on the red planet. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. You know, it's been just over 2 years since comedian and actor Robin Williams committed suicide. International Edition's David Byrd tells us now about a center in New York that is named for Williams and aims to help those seeking a career in entertainment.
The Robin Williams Center for actors, broadcasters, and recording artists will serve as a nurturing space for those who are trying to break into show business. The center features a 154-seat state-of-the-art theater and screening room. It will also have a multi-camera and broadcasting capability, and the center will be the home of the SAG-AFTRA Foundation's Conversations and the Business Educational Initiatives. At the center's opening, Billy Crystal, Robin Williams' longtime friend and collaborator on 10 comic relief broadcasts, said the center will provide free classes for the thousands of actors and comedians who are trying to break into show business.
Well, I think it means a great deal to all of this. 40,000 SAG-AFTRA members in New York City alone. So to have a place that is dedicated to helping the people who are not working and people who need help and connection and mentoring and just a place to come and feel connected, that's a fantastic thing, and that it has his spirit attached to it, which is a tremendous force. I think it's a great thing that SAG has done.
Crystal remembered Robin Williams as someone whose generosity and gentleness of spirit brought happiness to millions.
He was an incredibly talented man, we know, but he was also gentle of spirit and nothing but sharing and kindness, and I think that's what people need when, you know, times get rough, that you know that this building, if you walk in, and Robin was a big hugger. And you'll feel that, I think, when you walk into this building.
This is the first time that Williams' family has agreed to let his name be attached to something. Whoopi Goldberg, the third part of the Comic Relief trio, said that Robin Williams would probably be cracking jokes about the center, but she said she also deeply misses her friend.
I think he would think it was the silliest thing he'd ever heard. And he would make all kinds of jokes about it. And, you know, there's just not enough of them for me. You can't name enough things after him. I'd rather have him.
The Robin Williams Center is funded by a $16 million capital campaign that includes $6 million for the center and $10 million for the SAG-AFTRA Foundation's endowment. The center is located in the heart of New York's theater district. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And many thanks to you, Dave. One more story for you. Healthcare professionals and public health advocates worldwide are celebrating World Mental Health Day today. It's an effort to promote awareness of mental health issues as factors in first aid treatment plans. It is the 25th observance of Mental Health Day, and it, again, promoting mental and emotional health, ensuring access for everyone to care around the world. Thanks to you for listening to us today. I'll get it out in a moment. This is International Edition on The Voice of America. Stay tuned. Latest world news is just around the corner. For Tracy Carter, our director, our engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack and Coca-Cola North America President Sandy Douglas recently announced that their partnership to restore and protect damaged watersheds within national forest lands achieved a milestone of 1 billion liters of water restored, and that the partnership will commit to double that outcome through 2018. The 13 restoration areas are located within U.S. national forest land, the source of drinking water for more than 60 million Americans, and they can help ensure that future generations living nearby will have access to fresh water. This milestone that Coca-Cola, USDA, and our partners have reached is just the latest example of how partnerships between the public and private sectors can reach more people, harness more innovation, and do more good than either government or businesses can achieve alone, said Vilsack. America's 193 million acres of public forests and grasslands supply the drinking water for 60 million Americans, support approximately 200,000 full and part-time jobs, and contribute over $13 billion to local communities each year. This public-private sector partnership includes community organizations and taps their collective expertise to address increasing stress on water resources during challenging budget times. Dozens of local communities and hundreds of volunteers and youth work together on water resource management education and stewardship activities. The Carson National Forest in northern New Mexico is an example of the public-private partnerships approach. Local partners work together to help restore an alpine meadow and enhance a natural wetland habitat. By slowing the flow of Placer Creek, a tributary of the Rio Grande, the local team helped to restore a biodiverse meadow habitat and replenish the groundwater that contributes to the city of Santa Fe, New Mexico's water supply. The meadow restoration project is expected to help replenish approximately 49 million liters of water per year. One of the primary purposes of the 1897 Act that established our national forests was to ensure the long-term supply of water for our country, U.S. Forest Service Chief Tom Tidwell said. More than 100 years later, the stewardship of these public lands for forest and watershed health continues to be essential in ensuring an adequate water supply and providing high-quality water for needs across the United States.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.